Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Sarah Stevens, and my guest tonight is Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor. Jill Taylor is a Harvard-trained brain scientist who specializes in the post-mortem investigation of the human brain. She teaches locally at the IU School of Medicine and the IU Department of Kinesiology. She is a consulting neuroanatomist at the Midwest Proton Radiotherapy Institute, housed at the cyclotron, and she travels as the singing scientist for the Harvard Brain Bank. In addition, she is the president for the local affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, affectionately known to its members as NAMI. And, if that weren't enough, she designs and creates anatomically correct stained glass brains. Hi, Jill, and welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Jill, let's start at the beginning. How did you get interested in the brain?
Well, I grew up over in Terre Haute, Indiana, and I have a brother who is 18 months older than I, who was very different from me. And I recognized this even as a little person. And I recognized by the age of 3 or 4 or 5 years old that my brother was very different in the way he perceived information from the external world, in the way he processed that information, and then in the way he chose to behave. So I became fascinated with the human being. And, you know, as a little person, we don't know that some behavior is normal and some behavior is not normal. So all I could do is observe my environment. But because of my relationship with my brother, I started observing human behavior, physical, body language, how people communicate with one another, how people have emotional experiences. So I just became very focused and very fascinated with the human being at an early age.
So how did this lead you into the brain?
Well, biologically, my brother is the closest thing to me that exists in the universe. And as a sister and then later as a scientist, I wanted to understand why it was that I could connect my dreams to my reality and I could make my dreams come true. And I wanted to understand why it was that my brother could not connect his dreams to his reality, and they instead became delusion. And although my brother was not formally diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia, until he was in his mid-20s, he was showing signs of this, in my opinion, ever since he was a child.
In retrospect.
In retrospect, exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't until he was about 18, which is common for young males. Young males who are going to exhibit schizophrenia usually show their first psychotic break between the ages of 15 and 25. And about the age of 18, my brother became kind of depressed. And then later, he became delusional. And he began having audibles from God, which I interpreted as, from a biological perspective, as hallucination. So my brother's whole information processing was very unique and very different. And because of that, then I grew up and came to IU here in Bloomington, and I received 2 BAs. Because at that time, in order to get the human brain, I had to go physiological psychology as well as human biology. So I received 2 BAs here at IU. And then I chose to go back to ISU in Terre Haute and have a combined project there for neuroanatomy. So my degree is IU at ISU. There are 8 centers, medical centers, all over the state for the IU School of Medicine, and one of them is housed at Indiana State University. So my research opportunity was to study the brain, neuroanatomy, at the Terre Haute Center for Medical Research. So I did that, and during the same year that I was entering into neuroanatomy, my brother was formally diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so it completely shifted everything that I wanted to know and understand, and so I wanted to grow up to study schizophrenia.
Now, can you tell us just a little bit about your research?
After I graduated from Indiana State, then I received a postdoc at Harvard Medical School. So I moved to Boston, and I spent 2 years studying the brain in the Department of Neuroscience. And then I shifted from there to the Harvard Department of Psychiatry, where I finally got to do research on the postmortem investigation of the brain as it relates to schizophrenia. So I spent 5 years performing this research, but there's a natural shortage of tissue there. The Harvard Brain Bank is one of 3 federally funded brain banks in the country. And there's a shortage of brain tissue donated for research into the severe mental illnesses. And I thought, how can that be? Because because it's so prevalent. Mental illness is so prevalent in our society. So I decided that this was an educational issue, and I became a member of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I was on their national board of directors between 94 and 97. And at the same time, then I was performing research and I was traveling for the Brain Bank, talking to audiences about the beauty of the brain, that mental illnesses are biologically based brain disorders, and that there's a shortage of tissue donated for research. And as you can imagine, about partway through my presentation, my audience would realize, oh my gosh, she wants my brain. and the room, the tension in the room would get really thick. And I'd think, oh my gosh, you know, I'm a Hoosier girl. I'm a friendly girl. I'm traumatizing my audiences. So I had to come up with some way of making it palatable so that people would calm down and just listen and be open to the possibility of brain donation at the time of death. So that's when I decided to write the Brain Bank jingle. So I wrote the Brain Bank jingle, and whenever I travel now, I travel as the singing scientist for the Harvard Brain Bank. I carry my guitar. As soon as I'm going to talk about brain research and brain donation, I pull out my guitar, and I sing to them, just dial 1-800-BRAIN-BANK. And, you know, it lightens everything up, and people find it acceptable, and they're cool with it now. And it's like, okay, tell me everything I ever wanted to know about brain donation, because I really recognize the value of having this kind of tissue.
Well, now you've totally piqued the interest of the listening audience. We all want to hear you sing for brains, and since you have your guitar here, you're on.
Excellent. Oh, I am a brain banker, yes. Banking brains is what I do. Oh, I am a brain banker, asking for a deposit from you. Don't worry. Considered the contribution you can make when you are heaven bound. Your brain can hang around to help humanity find the key to unlock this thing we call insanity. Just dial 1-800-BRAIN-BANK for information, please. Educate, then donate. It's free. Why?
That was Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor singing live the Harvard Brain Bank jingle, 1-800-BRAIN-BANK. Okay, Jill, I'm donating my brain. Let's move on to a very transformational point in the life of your brain. What happened on the morning of December 10th, 1996?
On the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up to discover that I had a brain disorder of my own. I was experiencing a rare form of stroke. The kind of stroke I was having is called an arteriovenous malformation, or an AVM. And I woke up and I was having a severe pounding, caustic pounding, on the left side of my head, right behind my left eye. And it was just pounding. And it was very unusual for me to experience any kind of physical problem. I was in excellent physical condition. And I thought, okay, well, my normal exercise routine will help. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider. This is a full body, whole body exercise machine. And I turned on Shania Twain and I'm jamming away, having a great time. And the pounding in my head is just getting more and more severe. And as I'm looking at my arms as my torso is swinging back and forth on this machine and my arms are swinging back and forth, I'm looking at my hands and I'm recognizing that my hands seem very peculiar. They looked like claws hanging onto this bar. And I felt detached from my body. It was as though I was suspended somewhere between my normal reality and some esoteric space. And so I thought, okay, well, this can't be good. And so I got off the CardioGlider and I'm walking across my living room. And I'm recognizing that every step is very deliberate. And I recognize that the noises outside of my city apartment, because I'm living in the Boston area at this point, are becoming more and more quiet. And as I'm moving into my shower, I'm stepping into my shower, and I'm realizing that it is as though I'm listening to all the little voices, all the little muscles talking to one another, saying, okay, I got to contract. Okay, I got to relax. Okay, I got to, ooh, you got to catch her. She's getting ready to fall. And so I stepped into the tub, and I'm having all this very peculiar neurological experience, wondering, what is going on? And through the eyes of a neuroscientist, this process of deterioration was really fascinating. It took 4 hours for me to watch my mind completely deteriorate in its ability to process information coming in through my senses. And so once I got into the tub, I leaned against the wall and I recognized that I didn't know where I began and where I ended anymore. And it was as though the molecules making up my physical entity were blending with the molecules in the wall. And what essentially was going on is when you have an arteriovenous malformation, you have in normal vascularity to the brain, an artery is connected to a vein with a capillary network in between, because the artery is a very high pressure system and the venous system is a very low pressure system. So you have this neutral system, the capillary bed in between. And so everything functions normally. For an arteriovenous malformation, the artery is directly connected to the vein. And eventually the vein cannot handle the pressure because it's just not used to that kind of processing. It's not designed for that. And it blew, my vein blew right off of the artery. And when that happened, then there was a slow hemorrhage of blood passing into my left hemisphere of my brain. And in my brain, it happened right over the language center. So as soon as blood started spewing into the context of my cerebral cortex, certain groups of cells that are responsible for certain functions became drowned, and they were not capable of producing their function. So for me, having the AVM, it's a congenital disorder. I was born with it. They generally blow between the ages of 35 and 45, and I was 37 at the time. And with this type of stroke, it's a rare form of stroke, but it's the most common form of stroke that happens to people in their prime. So, and there's absolutely nothing that you can do except recognize the warning signs of stroke and try to get help as soon as you recognize that you're having any kind of major neurological problem.
Well, the logical next question then is, what are the warning signs of stroke?
The warning signs of stroke are S stands for speech or problems with language. T stands for tingling or numbness in the body. R stands for remembering or any problems with thinking. O stands for off balance or any problems with coordination. K stands for killer headache. And E stands for eyes, any problems with blurred vision.
So if you're experiencing any of those problems, you need to...
Stroke is an emergency. Dial 911. Get yourself help. Because as time goes on, if you are having... The problems only get worse. So if you can recognize that you're having a problem and still are capable of functioning with your ability, your muscles and your ability to pick up a phone, call for help or have someone call for help. And a lot of people say to me, but, you know, sometimes my eyes go blurry and it's, you know, how do I know? And it's like, well, if you're having neurological symptoms and you're not sure, call a friend. Call a friend immediately and say, you know, I'm feeling a little weird, okay? Mm-hmm. Call me back in 5 minutes. And if you don't get me, call 911, okay? Always err on the side of caution.
Okay. Now, you didn't call 911 immediately, and you probably didn't, I mean, in spite of your neurological training, did you realize you were having a stroke immediately? What were you thinking as you were blending into the walls of the shower?
Well, once I was in the shower and I was questioning what is going on in my mind. I'd never felt anything quite like this. I had had a history of migraine headache since I was 18 years old, but I would have maybe one migraine a year. And it was a classical symptoms of migraine with pounding behind the eye, tingling in part of my extremity, nausea in my stomach. So I thought, well, maybe, but I would only have one migraine a year. So I thought, well, maybe this was a migraine, but it really didn't feel similar to what I had been having. So eventually I get out of the shower and I dress mechanically for work, and I'm walking around my apartment and I'm thinking, work, work. Can I get to work? Can I drive? And in that instant, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. And it was in that moment that the neuroscientist woke up, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. And then it was like, wow, this is so cool. You know, because through the eyes of a neuroscientist, it's like, how many people have the opportunity to watch their own mind deteriorate like
this? You must have been the only person who ever felt that way while having a stroke.
Well, you know, but you don't have the fear. I was very fortunate. There's a center inside of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala, you have two of them. They're about the size of an almond nut, and you have one in each of your hemispheres. And the whole job of the amygdala is to ask the question. It doesn't ask it in language, but it is always observing your external environment and asking the question, am I safe? Am I safe? And when the amygdala feels safe, then other processes open up. And all of K through 12 learning, brain-based learning, is all based upon this relationship between the amygdala that asks the question, am I safe, and the structure right next to it, the hippocampus. And the hippocampus, the job of that is for memory and learning, new memory and the ability to learn. So, and they sit right next to one another, and they have this wonderful relationship so that when the amygdala is saying, yes, I feel safe, then the hippocampus can turn on and it can learn and memorize new information, and a child feels safe in their environment and everything is familiar and they absorb like their beautiful brain is designed for them to absorb. And when the amygdala says, no, I am not safe, then the hippocampus essentially gets shut down. The anxiety level goes up. Norepinephrine gets shot into the body. And we are in a reactive state of being. So for me, I was very fortunate that my amygdala, for some reason, was not saying, no, I am not safe.
And which is amazing.
Which is absolutely amazing. But it must have been somehow influenced by the hemorrhage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was really a very exciting experience. As long as I was going to recover, you know, as long as I had the perception that, okay, I'm going to get help and they're going to, you know, with time I'm going to be okay. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a hemorrhage, you know. I don't have time to have a stroke. So
yeah, who does?
Who does, you know? So it's like, okay, well, you know, I'll do this for a week and then, okay, then I'll get back on my normal routine. And in the meantime, I'll learn everything that I'm supposed to learn from this incredible opportunity.
Now, that's a very good plan, but I think it took a little longer than a week. how did you manage to get help?
Well, it was one of the things that went out for me. I went into my office space, and I had a 3-inch stack of business cards there. And I, you know, what was happening inside of my mind was I had lost my mind became silent. When you think about your own normal processing, your left hemisphere for most of us is the dominant language centers. And for me, when the language center was flooded in a pool of blood, I lost all the little brain chatter going on. You have normal voices in there that say, my name is Jill. This is my phone number. This is my address. I'm an individual. I'm a solid. I'm separate from you. And so this is all of my ego center, and it's related to my language telling me who I am and feeding me all this information constantly so that I don't forget. And on that morning, all those voices became very, very quiet. And when they became quiet, I shifted in my consciousness from my left hemisphere to the consciousness of my right hemisphere. And the right hemisphere is all about right here, right now. Right here, right now, this is a perfect moment. It doesn't matter if I can't walk or talk or do anything normally. This is a perfect moment. And I was shifted into the consciousness of where people who meditate, and they work so hard to meditate through their sounds or through their thoughts or through their rituals in order to get to a space of silence to quiet that left hemisphere. It opens up this expansiveness of the consciousness of the right hemisphere, which is right here, right now. I was perfect. I was whole. I was beautiful. I was existing in a state of euphoria. And so what I recognized was that there are two completely different consciousnesses that blend together inside of our single head. And we think, well, because I'm an individual, I have one consciousness, not really recognizing that there is a unique difference in what each of those two hemispheres process and what they do. For example, in the left hemisphere, there's a clock. And that clock sits and ticks in the back of the left hemisphere, giving linearity to my thoughts. And when you have language, which is also in that left hemisphere, you have to be able to get from A to B to C because you're using language and it sets itself up in structure, in a linear structure, so that we can communicate. But when I lost the clock and I lost the language, I lost all of my attachment to my past, all my memories of my past, and I lost my attachment to all the projection of my image of myself into the future. So all I had was this moment. And I would have what I call waves of clarity that would come into my mind and say, oh, I can attach to the external world. So I went into my office, I found my set stack of business cards, and I thought, I'm going to find my business card. I'm going to call my colleague at work, and he will get me help. And so I thought, okay, that's easy. I work at the Harvard Brain Bank. I have little brains inside on my business card. So I'll just find the business card that's got a little brain on it. I'll take that data, and then I'll call my colleague at work, and everything will be just fine. And what I realized, though, when I looked at the first card on the top of that stack, was that I could not make any sense out of the information there.
So you couldn't read anymore.
I could not read anymore. Uh-huh. And I could not distinguish language or symbols from the background pixels of that card. It had been reduced through my eyes to pixels. And then I would have to wait for a wave of clarity. And so it took me 45 minutes to get an inch down in that stack before I found my business card. 45 minutes.
I really wonder what was happening during those waves of clarity physiologically.
I wonder, because when you think about the hemorrhage, I ended up with a hemorrhage in my brain the size of my fist. And how in that hemorrhage were there any connections being made enough for me to save my life and orchestrate my rescue?
Wow.
Yeah, it's really it's a great drama. It's a great story.
So tell me, you finally were able to connect what was on that card.
Right.
To the phone.
Well, by this time I knew what a phone would do, but I didn't really remember anything else about the phone. And I would have waves of clarity, so I put the pad of the phone right next to this business card, and I looked at the squiggles for the phone number on the business card, and I matched that squiggle on the phone pad squiggle. And then I had to cover it up with my finger after I pushed that button, because otherwise I wouldn't know, I would lose my wave of clarity would end.
You'd lose your place.
I would lose my place, and then I didn't know where I was. So I had to do this process in order to get through the phone number. So finally, I get the phone number dialed, and I'm listening to the phone, and I'm preparing to say, this is Jill. I need help. And my colleague answers the phone, and it's rah, 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 and I'm thinking, rah, rah, rah. And so then I say to him, this is Jill. I need help. But what actually comes out of my mouth is rah, rah, rah. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I sound like a golden retriever. I didn't know that I couldn't speak until I tried to speak. Because in my mind's eye, I could still see my business card perfectly well. I just couldn't recognize it in the external world. In my inner ear, I could still hear myself say, this is Jill, I need help, but I couldn't get it out in normal communication for the external world.
How frustrating.
Oh, it was fascinating. It was by this point, you know, I'm really feeling like I need to get some help.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, people say, well, you know, Jill, why didn't you just go downstairs and ask your landlady? She was home on maternity leave. Well, she didn't exist for me. She was in that pool of cells. The memory of her didn't exist anymore. And people say, well, why didn't you just go out to the street and flag somebody down and, you know, talk to them? They'd obviously see there was a problem and take you to a hospital. And it was like, that didn't exist for me anymore. Wow. So that's why I say, if you have a warning signs of stroke, get help as soon as you possibly can. Put the action into motion, because you don't know when you're not going to be able to have that motion. Even if cognitively you think that you can, getting what's inside your brain out through into the external world can be a real problem.
Right. Wow. So then what happened?
Well, my colleague came and he picked me up and he took me to the hospital. And
it's amazing that he was able to understand the golden retriever language that you were speaking.
Well, you know, I kind of howl up and down the halls at work. And so he,
so they recognized that.
He recognized my squawk. And he could immediately, he's a neuroscientist, he knew immediately that I was having some kind of serious problem. So he came to my home and picked me up and took me to the hospital. And they gave me a CAT scan. And it's interesting that the fellow who actually did the CAT scan, here I am in Mount Auburn Hospital in the Boston area, Cambridge. The guy who did that was actually from Terre Haute, Indiana. Aww. So there was this instant connection. I have no idea who that person was. But he was very kind to me. And so they recognized, yes, she's having a major hemorrhage. And then they shipped me across Boston in an ambulance to Mass General Hospital. And, you know, on the way across Boston, I curled up into a little fetal ball. And by this point, I just didn't have any energy left. I had done everything that I could do to orchestrate my rescue. And I was just so depleted of strength and energy that my whole consciousness at this point had completely shifted into this present moment. And I just moved deeper and deeper into a consciousness of peacefulness and bliss. And so I curled up into a little ball and I experienced, from my perspective, I felt my spirit surrender. That's the only way I know how to describe it. My body went limp. I was at that point unconscious. And there was euphoria. I just experienced euphoria. So by the time I got to Mass General Hospital, they whisked me out into the emergency room, and they worked miracles on me. Kudos to all those doctors who brought me my body back to stabilization. And my neurologist said, you know, it's going to be 2 years before we have any idea at all what this girl's going to, her recovery's going to be. So you know, within the course of 4 hours, I went from a Harvard brain scientist at Harvard Medical School to I was now an infant in a woman's body. I could not walk. I could not talk. All stimulation coming in from the external world was chaos and painful. So it was all I wanted to do was get away from the light, get away from the sounds, and just go get out of the pain, all stimulation coming in through my sensory systems, pain, and then go into this bliss, this space of euphoria.
Wow.
Yeah.
So now, how long did that last, and then what did they do for you?
Well, it's interesting. 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, I had a craniotomy, a stereotaxic craniotomy, and they went in and they opened my head and they removed a blood clot the size of a golf ball. And prior to that, I was very fortunate. Although I had lost all ability to process information, I retained the ability to learn. And so although I was essentially an infant, I had incredible learning ability. And the way that I saw it was I was sitting normal information processing. I'm sitting in the middle of my brain, and my head is lined with filing cabinets. And for normal processing, I have an idea. I open up the file that's – or find the right cabinet. I find the right drawer. I open up the file. I get out the detailed information, and I thank my brain for, you know, retrieving information. And so that's normal processing. And on the morning of the stroke, it was more like I knew all this stuff, but I couldn't find any of it. So it's as though all those filing cabinets that lined my head, my brain, were pushed just beyond my reach so that I knew all this stuff. I just couldn't find it anywhere. And so in my opinion, Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor, the woman who I had been prior to the stroke, she died that morning. And for the process of recovery, it was very important to me that my family and my friends recognized that I'm no longer that person, but I didn't die. And because I didn't die, there were so many things that I learned from this opportunity, and it was incredible gifts. To me, having had this experience has shifted my perspective on who we are as living beings and what we are and how I want to live my life. So it was a deeply profound and moving opportunity for me to live life again and to make new decisions and to figure out, okay, who am I now? I was living a really large life before. I was on the board of directors of NAMI. I was a brain researcher at Harvard. I was singing scientists, singing for brains. I was doing very constructive things with my life. And for some reason now, it's kind of funny. I had been out preaching about how does our brain create our perception of reality. And so I say that the universe wanted me to learn up close and personal. Okay, Jill, you want to know how your brain creates its perception of reality? Let's take your ability away and give you an opportunity to rebuild that.
Well, in the process of rebuilding, what was your biggest challenge?
I would say that the biggest challenge for me was the decision to come back. You have to picture yourself in a space of, who I was before didn't exist anymore. And because she didn't exist anymore, none of her program reactivity existed anymore. I didn't have any anger. I didn't have any programs, old programs. So I was like a newborn setting up new circuitry, setting up new wiring inside of my brain. And right now I'm sitting over in bliss in where meditators want to be. And I got to just sit in the silence and to recognize that this is an option for me. I did not have to recover. Recovery was my choice. You can have the best scientists and the best doctors and the best rehabilitators working on you, but if you don't want to recover, you're not going to, because you're not going to invest yourself in the process. So for me, it was making that decision that I was going to separate myself from this incredible experience of bliss and move back into trying to process information like at the speed that everybody else was processing, because
which was probably kind of painful at first.
Oh, it was terribly painful. The world, normal information processing for normal people, we move 1,000,000 miles an hour. That's an exaggeration, but maybe not. And I was off in la-la land having a wonderful time. I was out in the flow. When the clock is sitting and ticking behind your left hemisphere, it's, oh, you got a moment. Oh, you got a moment. Oh, that one's gone. You got to get a new one. And for me, instead of that, I had a moment that was slow and peaceful and
so it was
I could
a continuous
breathe.
Meditation.
Oh, it was beautiful. Colors became vivid and sounds became pure. And as long as I tuned myself out from the just basic chaos that goes on in an environment. Oh, yeah, I had found a peace, a blissful peace deep inside of me that I never knew existed. And when I stop and think about the consciousness of that language center in the left hemisphere that is constantly saying, I am, I am, I am, got a rush, got a new moment, I'm behind, blah, blah, blah. It's just pushing, pushing, pushing. To not have that was just an incredibly euphoric experience for me.
So considering all of that, why would you choose to come back? What was the motivation?
I think that for me, well, I'm sure that for me it was recognizing that this peace exists inside of each one of us. And I think if more people recognize that they have two consciousnesses inside of their brain, they have a left hemisphere consciousness that is all about language, all about linearity, all about that clock – all about all those gifts and skills that we exude out into the world. Left hemisphere has wonderful tools, but the right hemisphere is right here, right now. And there's a bliss and there's a joy. And there's whenever you experience your own joy, you are in your right hemisphere. You're right here, right now. There's a smile deep inside each one of us. And some of us never smile. And some of us were just trigger happy smilers, you know? And so joy is in that right hemisphere. And so for me, I think my motivation to come back was to help people recognize that we have a choice. We make a choice moment by moment by moment, whether or not we want to be in the left hemisphere consciousness or whether we want to be in the right hemisphere consciousness. And that is a very palpable and real choice. And we can learn when are we in our left hemisphere and when are we in our right hemisphere.
Wow, that's fascinating. And come back you have in every way. The thing that amazes me the most is that no one would ever know that you'd had a stroke. You've totally recovered.
Well, I have totally recovered, but I have to say that I am not the same person that I was before. I look like her. I walk like her. I talk like her. I bounce around like her. I love the brain just like she did, but I do things really very differently because now I know that there is this inner peace. And so I have completely recovered, but I do things differently now.
And how do you mean? What's different?
Well, I live more with kindness in my heart. I'm more sympathetic to other people's reality. I'm much more tuned in to different people, process information in different ways, and that we are ultimately a product of our youth and of the circuitry inside of the brain that we get set up with when we're little people. And so I'm much more sympathetic to individuals, and I live my life just as a more kind and compassionate human being than I did before.
Is there any piece of music that you would like to play that would speak to your newfound understanding?
I absolutely adore Carrie Newcomer's Bare to the Bone. I think that this song says what my experience has been and how I look at life now more clearly than any other words. When she says that what we do in love and kindness is all we'll ever leave behind, it speaks what my heart feels.
Here I am without a message. Here I stand with empty hands. Just a spirit tired of wandering like a stranger in this land. Walking wide-eyed through this world is the only way I've known. Wrapped in hope and good intention, bare to the bone. There is nothing I won't show you, nothing I'd have. Risk it all and dreamt it all, and seldom question why. It took me in when I was hungry, when my spirit ached and groaned. Laid wide open and defenses bare to the bone.
That was Carrie Newcomer's Bare to the Bone, music chosen by our guest, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, on Profiles. Jill, you know, I'm sure our listening audience is wondering how to access that euphoria that you're describing, other than by having a stroke. It would be nice to be able to access it at will.
Yeah.
And then turn it off when you need to meet the demands of the clock.
I think that we all get there. I think that the key is paying attention to what's going on inside of your own head. And when you are kicking back and you are feeling joy, all right, that's when you are in the consciousness of your right hemisphere. Pay attention to what your body feels like. The right hemisphere consciousness is pretty much the consciousness of your body. The consciousness of the left hemisphere is pretty much the consciousness of your ego center. I am an individual. I am separate. I am solid. The right hemisphere, when I lost the left hemisphere, I became fluid. Because I am a fluid. We are fluid individuals. We think of ourselves as a single and a solid, but we are fluid individuals made up of trillions of cells. And when I stop and I think about my body, the typical adult body is made up of approximately 50 trillion cells. So every cell is packaged with the exact same DNA, genetic code, as the original cell, the zygote cell, which was the original combination of the egg cell and the sperm cell. So that egg cell and sperm cell came together. They created a new form of DNA. And then that cell metamorphosized itself into who you are today by repackaging, multiplying its DNA, and then repackaging that new DNA inside of a new cell structure. So ultimately, one cell became two cells became four cells became et cetera, et cetera. Now, every cell in your body, except for the red blood cells, of course, contain an exact copy of that DNA. So that original zygote cell had the molecular genius capable of metamorphosizing itself into who you are. So I look at my body and I recognize that every cell in my body then is a molecular genius. So I look at my body and I walk around the earth like I am the life force power of 50 trillion molecular geniuses. Now, you walk into a room and you can walk in as a single, as a solid, as a separate, and you are vulnerable because you are separate from the flow of the universe. And all you have to decide is, oh my gosh, I am the life force power of 50 trillion molecular geniuses. I am so cool. So are you. Let's make this world a better place. Okay? So to me, it's a choice. You get there by deciding you want to be there. You allow yourself to run the circuitry of your right hemisphere, which says, I am the power of life. I am beautiful. I am whole. I am equal to every other person on the planet, because this is where equality is. We are all one. I think of each human individual as we are the different cells of the human population on this planet. And we're trying to make this world a better place, so we have to spend time in our right hemisphere consciousness saying, what can I do to make this situation better? It's also the site of our higher consciousness. Every time you make a decision, moment by moment by moment, okay, you drive through McDonald's and you get French fries and you didn't order them. Well, do you eat them or do you take them back? You know, well, you know if you take them back, they're going to throw them out anyway. But what is your right, what is the higher good going to say? The higher good is going to say, take them back. All right. So moment by moment by moment, we are making decisions. And the closer we pay attention to when am I in my right hemisphere naturally and feel that, it's all about feeling. Recovery from any kind of disorder, in my opinion, is also all about feeling. For me to be able to recover my body, I had to hold in my mind, what does it feel like to take steps two at a time? That was my one physical goal, because my body was so weak. In the beginning, I couldn't roll over. I had to learn to roll over, and then I couldn't sit up, and then I had to sit up and learn to sit up.
So you had to go through all of the baby milestones one by one.
All the baby milestones. Wow. And my mother's the blessed angel of my life, who moved into my world and took over. She recognized one day I had a Harvard doctor daughter, is what she used to call me. And then I was an infant again. And she just came to Boston and moved back into my life. And she started from scratch with me. So she taught me how to roll over. She taught me how to sit up. She taught me how to walk. She taught me eventually how to speak. She taught me how to read. She taught me how to write.
She taught you math?
She taught me, well, math was the last thing to come. Yeah, math was kind of a problem. It was about 8 years before math came back. But, you know, I can do some basic calculations. Don't ask me any. But it's in there. It's in there. But so some of the cells inside of my brain had to rewire. Many of the cells in my brain just had to, it was like these files were there, but I had to be reintroduced to, I didn't know that I was an artist until I walked into my stained glass room. I had a whole room in my apartment that was just for stained glass. I didn't know that I was a musician until I walk in and I see my guitar and I see my cello. So I didn't know these things until I went and had the experience, and then those files were opened. And, you know, the beauty of losing your mind is you don't know what you've lost.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, well, people ask me, do you remember everything? And it's like, well, do you remember everything about your childhood?
Wow. How did you relearn the information you had known as a PhD, as a brain scientist? What did you do to relearn the information about your own research?
Well, I was given a very wonderful opportunity to teach at Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute. They needed someone to come over and teach anatomy. And I said, that's great. I'll commute because I live in Bloomington. But it would be really great if I could teach two classes because I'm already commuting. And they said, fine, what would you like to teach? And I said, well, I'd like to teach neuroscience. I'd like to teach the brain. And no one had taught neuroscience at Rose Holman before. A bunch of engineers, very left hemisphere information processing versus a biological thinking. So I thought that'd be, you know, a great challenge. So they hired me, and so I relearned my anatomy and my neuro to teach it the next day. So I would go over to, and I'd stay at my mom's, and I would learn what I was going to learn, and I'd go in the next day, and I'd teach it like I'd known it forever.
How did you relearn it?
I just sat down with my book. See, the beauty of one of the differences between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere is that the left hemisphere thinks in language, so all of the terminology. The right hemisphere thinks in pictures. So I didn't forget what all the muscles and the bones look like. I didn't forget what all the brain circuits look like. So I retained that visual map. I just forgot all the terminology.
Right.
So I had to go back and just sit down with the books and draw pictures and then relabel everything. And the way that I think, the left hemisphere thinks, is in pictures or is in stories. So I would create a story about the pictures using the vocabulary, try to make it remotely interesting for these people, these students, and then I would go in and I would teach it.
And that reinforced it too.
It absolutely reinforced it. Yeah, when you have, you know, it's one thing to learn it. When you learn it to teach it, you truly learn it.
That's
you
right.
You have to, because you have to look at it as a bigger picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, can you talk a little bit more about the differences between the two consciousnesses?
Well, there are actually some really good books out there about the consciousness of the right hemisphere. And, you know, a lot of professionals will say, oh, you know, there is no difference between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. Well, I would invite them to lose one or the other in order to you know, really get an idea of how different they do process. The thing about the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere is they complement one another. They process the same information, but they do it differently. Say, for example, the language center. You have language centers also in your right hemisphere, but they process sound differently than the left hemisphere. When I say the word dog, dog, dog is a sound. So the right hemisphere is hearing the sound dog. The right hemisphere and the right hemisphere is also placing a picture of a dog. So if you had a flash of a certain dog, then that's your right hemisphere. When I say dog and you think very specifically and interpret the meaning of the word dog, that's what the left hemisphere is doing. Or if you think of a very specific category or species of dog, then that's your left hemisphere. So the two hemispheres complement one another. Another good example is if I say, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Would you believe me? Even if you knew me?
No.
Okay. So your right hemisphere is saying, I love you. You're hearing that my voice is angry. Your left hemisphere is hearing the words, I love you, and they know what that means. And they also know what affect or emotion usually supports that when it is genuine. So the right hemisphere is saying, I'm not thinking that she's being genuine because it's recognizing the intonation or the inflection of my voice, as opposed to the meaning of the word. So the two hemispheres work together in order for me to be able to understand language and in order for me to be able to process information like a normal human being.
That's interesting. And so the left hemisphere has little verbal loops or circuits.
Exactly. You have we all establish circuitry. Cells communicate with cells with chemicals called neurotransmitters. And cells communicate with cells creating circuits. And circuits communicate with circuits creating systems. And systems communicate with systems creating networks. Networks communicate with networks creating hemispheres. And then the right hemisphere communicates with the left hemisphere. And you have a brain inside of your head. So essentially, a circuit is established when certain cells are communicating communicating with other certain cells and on a routine basis with a certain chemical flow that works. And the thing about the brain is what we call reverberating circuitry. Let's say I got a group of cells and they're all communicating with one another, and they do it a lot. And so it takes less stimulation from the external world to come in order to stimulate that circuit for that circuit to run. And so it reverberates with minimal external stimulation. So most of us, we're sitting around and our language center is just going on all the time. And it's saying all this stuff. And it's designed to do that. The language center cells are designed to take information coming in from the external world, make a story about it so that I feel safe in the external world, like the external world's a safe place and I can feel familiar here and I can feel safe here. So the brain is designed to set up these storylines, and they get established, the loops, the circuits get established during our first couple of years of life. So if I'm an infant and I'm born into this world and I make a little peep and my mom comes running and she takes care of my needs, then I learn that all I have to do is make a little peep when I'm feeling distress and someone will aid me. But if I'm a little infant and I have to scream and scream and scream and scream and scream and scream and scream some more, then I'm setting up a different kind of loop on how I react and interact with my external world in order to get my needs fit. And the thing is that the lower loops of the reptilian brain, or the brainstem region in the lower portion of our cortex, these don't know time. There's no time there, so that they never age. So even though I'm in my 40s, I have a 2-year-old inside of me who has never aged because I set up those loops when I was 2. They worked when I was 2, or they didn't work, but that was the way I learned to interact with the external world. So that is always right there beneath my higher cognitive abilities, because as we get older, we have the cerebral cortex grow out beyond that, and so now I can recognize, I can take new pictures of this new reality and say, oh, my reactivity doesn't have to be triggered anymore because I'm safe. I'm safe. I'm an adult. I can deal with this. I can smile about this. I can look at this as an adult would look at this, as opposed to just bumping into my old reactivity.
So when we're interacting with other people and have frustrating interactions, yeah, it would be wise to look at them and realize that, you know, if they're expressing a lot of negativity, we might be dealing with some of their 2-year-old loops as well.
Exactly, because we're all made up of loops. And it's a matter of some of us look at our own loops and refine those with, you know, a higher cerebral cortex ability to look at things with a new perspective, and some of us just don't. But you're exactly right. We are all constantly bumping up against our loops. And if you look at somebody who is coming at you as anger or with hostility, if you just recognize that this person, you've triggered their loop, then they'll come to calm down if you don't feed that loop. But that you're also not responsible for their loop, and that, you know, we all have individual loops. You're not responsible for my loops. I'm not responsible for your loops. But I can see that I triggered your loop, and I have a choice in that moment. And this is one of those opportunities to step to the right. I call it stepping to the right, when you choose to step into the consciousness of your right hemisphere. I can look at you with compassion and love and understanding, and I can be a decent and kind human being nurturing to you. Or I can step into my left hemisphere, my own reactivity. I can bump my reactivity up against your reactivity, and we're just going to have a lovely experience of angry and fight. You know, and there's a satisfaction about that because it's so familiar. I know who I am when I'm angry.
So this consciousness sort of immunizes us against being drawn into reactive interactions with
Absolutely.
Other people.
It's a choice. We make choices moment by moment whether or not we want to be in our right hemisphere or in our left hemisphere. It's a choice. We are so much more powerful as living beings, as human beings, because we have these two hemispheres than most of us give ourselves credit for.
Right.
And when you recognize that you are the life force power of 50 trillion molecular geniuses, then you can stand as an individual, own your power, and recognize that other person over there is in pain.
Right. And they are the power of 50 trillion molecular geniuses too.
Exactly. What can I do to help soothe you so that you can own your power again and show up again as you really want to show up on the planet?
Absolutely. What a healthy way of approaching this. There's so much to talk about, and we've run out of time. I see you've got a last musical selection here. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. I think that pretty much sums it all up.
Well, we'll go out on this one. It's been great talking to you, Jill.
Thank you, Sarah.
My guest on this edition of Profiles has been brain scientist and stroke survivor Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. Jill, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I'm Sarah Stevens, and thanks for listening.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.